fields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to start the week with politics, but it is a political story that is hitting close to home for many Americans and, as it turns out, for the White House. There was a very personal message from the White House this weekend about the hundreds of schoolgirls who were kidnapped in Nigeria in April by religious extremists. First Lady Michelle Obama focused on the issue for her Mother's Day video statement.
And I want you to know that Barack has directed our government to do everything possible to support the Nigerian government's efforts to find these girls and bring them home. In these girls, Barack and I see our own daughters. We see their hopes and their dreams. And we can only imagine the anguish their parents are feeling right now.
But some Republicans have criticized the Obama administration's response on this and other foreign policy issues for not focusing on the problem simmering in international hotspots until there is a crisis. That's an argument that is also in play about the House Select Committee on Benghazi. That committee is set to investigate the attack in Libya that claimed the lives of four Americans in 2012. We wanted to talk more about this in other political news, so we've called Ron Christie once again. He is a former assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. He's now a Republican strategist and communications advisor. Welcome back to the program, Ron. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks to be with you today.
Also joining us, Ken Rudin. He is the host of the Political Junkie radio show on PRX. Ken Rudin, back to you. Welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
So let's start with you, Ken, because we heard a moment ago part of First Lady Michelle Obama's remarks about those kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls. Ken, what does it say about the administration's approach that the First Lady weighed in like this?
Well, you know, there are a lot of criticisms, and a lot of them are valid, of Obama administration foreign policy. Certainly, we could debate whether Benghazi falls into that category, but you can make the argument that we are either unprepared or just dithering with Ukraine. But when it comes to the kidnapping of children in Nigeria, it goes beyond the pale, and it goes beyond criticism of public policy. The only question some people seem to have is that whether walking around with placards saying "Bring back our girls" is either too simplistic or almost an amateur hour, in the sense that we've got to do more than just walk around with signs with a hashtag about this tragedy. But it is indeed a tragedy, and it just shows what's going on around the world, that to paraphrase our parents, it's a crazy world out there.
Well, okay, but Ken, could you focus a little bit more on my specific question, which was that she's saying that they're not just walking around with signs and hashtags. They're saying that there are specific steps that the administration is taking to support the Nigerian government.
Yes, we do see that the Nigerian government is turning down a lot of that request as far as, you know, help from international, from other countries to find these children. And of course, we did see something from Amnesty International that said that there was a warning about what these extremist groups were about to do. And I think an Amnesty spokesperson said the other day that this abduction could have been prevented. So just like with Benghazi, when a Senate Intelligence Committee said that could have been prevented, there are a lot of things that people are doing after the fact, but perhaps maybe the questions that are being raised are what could have been done beforehand.
So, Ron, let's hear from you. Is there a sort of a specific Republican critique of the administration on this point? I just want to note that House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, who's a Michigan Republican, was on Face the Nation on Sunday, and he said, quote, in part, quote, you can't base your policy based on what's trending on Twitter. It has to be more than hashtags and selfies. Is that the crux of the critique, or is there more?
There's more to it than that, Michelle. I think my main critique here with the administration is that, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton refused to put this terrorist group, Boko Haram, on the terrorist watch list. So if you have an administration that looks at a particular group that is rooted in Islamic fundamentalism, that has killed thousands of people, and you start to wonder, does the administration have a coherent strategy of winning the war on terrorism? And of course, we've heard overseas contingency operations. We've heard that these are man-made disasters. No, these are Islamist terrorists who are intent on killing people based on their Christian belief. And in the case of these girls, look, a hashtag "bring back our girls" isn't going to cut it. I think we needed to have a more coherent foreign policy, a more coherent geopolitical strategy. And unfortunately, what we see here again is the administration acting after the fact as opposed to having a coherent political strategy and foreign policy strategy in place beforehand.
Let me ask you a tough question, Ron, is that obviously on a humanitarian basis, this is a very distressing and upsetting. And, you know, I think, you know, the First Lady certainly spoke to it when she said that this reminds a lot of people of their girls. Is there any American interest in this apart from the humanitarian? Is there a critique around that, or whether the U.S. should be involved in something like this at all?
Well, two things here. One, I think the United States needs to step up, along with our allies, of rooting out those who seek to destroy the Western way of life based on our ideology, based on our religion, based on our cultures. And unfortunately, that seems to be rooted in Islamic terrorists. But from a humanitarian standpoint, how can we not do everything that we have, all the resources that we bring to bear in the United States, that we should use our intelligence, we should use our military? We need to bring these girls home. Michelle, this is a very important message for the world that says that the United States and those in the West will stand for those who need the most help in the most dire of circumstances. And I think those 226 or so remaining girls who are in captivity need our help.
If you're just joining us, we're having our political chat. We are speaking with Republican strategist Ron Christie and political junkie host Ken Rudin. So, Ken Rudin, Benghazi, both of you brought it up. The House has formed a special committee to investigate how the Obama administration handled those attacks there. That was in 2012. It left 4 Americans dead. It was decided on a party line vote, and some Democrats are talking about boycotting this altogether, saying that this is a politically motivated witch hunt. And so, Ken, what are the Democrats' objections to this process?
Well, they'll argue that there's been, you know, countless number of Senate and House committees. There's been a scathing report already by the Senate Intelligence Committee saying, yes, it could have been prevented. It was just abominable that there was not better security. And then there are a lot of Democrats who said that the Republicans are trying to rally their base and excite their base the way they are about Obamacare, and hoping that Benghazi is another way of appealing to that base. But at the same time, the Republicans say, look, I think clearly it seemed like Benghazi was fading as an issue for a couple of months until this Ben Rhodes White House email from September of 2012 resurfaced. And the fact is, the question is, if the congressional committees asked for all the pertinent emails last year, why wasn't this email included as part of it? Now, ultimately, what the email shows that the White House was concerned about political fallout, and they wanted to make sure that President Obama's reelection was not in jeopardy, because they kept saying in 2012 that the war against al-Qaeda is being won. So for an administration to try to spin a tragedy in a favorable way, well, that's not unusual at all. We saw that going on in Iraq for years. But the point is, the White House basically helped the Republican Party by failing to give this latest round of emails when they were supposed to, and now they're backtracking.
Ron, you wrote an op-ed about this for the Daily Beast titled Why Democrats Are So Afraid of Benghazi. So I think you heard, Ken, I think, gave you kind of the lay of the land, but can I ask you, though, about those who say that this is still politically motivated, as evidenced by the fact that some people were even fundraising on this question? Why do you answer that?
Well, I think it's absolutely abominable for people to fundraise off of this. Former Governor Mitt Romney said that it was okay for Republicans to fundraise about this. That's absolutely the wrong approach to take. This should be about the truth. The truth is this. We know that 4 Americans were killed in Benghazi on the evening of September 11th, but we don't know why. We don't know why, when Britain and other nations that had consulates in Benghazi withdrew due to safety concerns, why the United States remained. We don't know why the President of the United States, after he was told of this attack at 5 p.m. on September 11th, remained incommunicado for 8 hours. And we also don't know why the military in AFRICOM, which is based in Germany, but which is oversees the African continent, did not scramble any sort of military response. Now, I think the administration, and Ken was spot on, the administration brought this on itself. There were lawfully subpoenaed documents that should have been provided, and the administration failed to disclose that particular email by Ben Rhodes that said that the talking points should stress that this was not a failure in policy, but instead it was due to a video, which we know to be false. So I think the administration, for their lack of candor, brought this investigation on themselves, and it should not be political. It should be about the truth.
So before we let you go, we have about 2 minutes left. Two comeback stories in the news. I'm not sure everybody agrees with my language on that, but we'll call it that, you know, for now. Mitt Romney, two-time presidential contender, came out to say he supports raising the minimum wage. Here he is on MSNBC. Actually, we're not going to play it. We don't have time for that. And then also, Monica Lewinsky is back in the news with her essay for Vanity Fair about her relationship with then-President Bill Clinton, and she wrote, "It's time to burn the beret and bury the blue dress." So, Ken, I'm going to ask you, which of those two stories engages you? Comment on either one, if you would.
Well, the Monica Lewinsky story, the saga, saddens me only because, I mean, she was just so discredited and humiliated during that whole thing, and of course, the president was as well. The fact that he was censured impeached by the House. But so it's kind of like Jack Bauer. I think they had their time in the limelight. I think, you know, the least we hear about them is fine with me. But I'm interested in the Mitt Romney thing because there was a clear divide in the Republican Party over things like minimum wage. Polls show it's a winning issue. And I think the Democrats, just as the Republicans love to talk about Benghazi and Obamacare, the Democrats can talk about minimum wage and pay equity, and they're going to have a winning issue if the Republican Party doesn't pay attention to those polls.
Ron, we don't have a minute left, so why don't you take the Mitt Romney question, right or wrong on this, do you think? Where are you on that?
I think he's wrong. I think the economics of this, if you look, there are about 1.2 million people on minimum wage between the ages of 16 and 24, comprise half of that population. The Congressional Budget Office has speculated that this could kill up to 1 million jobs. So I'm a little skeptical of raising the minimum wage in such a way that it would actually throw more people out of work than there are who are on the wage, I think is the wrong way to go about it. But very briefly, I agree with Ken, and I think that looking at Monica Lewinsky, look, her whole life was discredited by the actions of someone who I would say, if you want to say there's a war on women, a predator who was in the Oval Office who preyed upon a young girl and her life was destroyed as a result of it. I think it's a tragedy.
Ron Christie is a Republican strategist with us from our bureau in New York. Ken Rudin is host of the Political Junkie radio show on PRX. We reached him at his home office in Maryland. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Always
Thanks,
a
Michelle.
Pleasure.
Coming up, the digital cloud is so convenient. More and more people are shipping their personal digital documents, pictures, and other files to the cloud. And that might make you wonder, just how safe is it? We'll try to find out. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, how the government came to spy on millions of Americans. We talk with Michael Kirk, director of the new PBS Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. It tells the history of the NSA's data collection program and the government's attempts to keep it quiet. We'll also hear from two former NSA analysts who were interviewed in the documentary. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages is celebrating 26 years of trading fairly in Champaign-Urbana, offering eco-friendly handcrafted decor and gift items from around the world. A gift from 10,000 Villages is a gift that gives twice.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. That's a time set aside to acknowledge the contributions of people from these backgrounds to the bigger American story. Undeniably, when many Americans look for role models for educational achievement, many find them in Asian American homes. Now, the idea of Asian Americans as academic powerhouses has been fueled in recent years by many things, but perhaps most publicly by Yale Law Professor Amy Chua, author of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother and co-author of The Triple Package. Now, we've spoken spoken with her about both of these books, and she argued that the extremely high standards and no-nonsense style that she sees among Chinese-American parents is what accounts for better grades and higher test scores. Now, one criticism of Amy Chua's work has always been that her background in these areas is actually very slight. Well, two scholars who do have a background in this wanted to dig into the question, and they say that the story of Asian-American achievement is much more complicated. They are both sociology professors. Jennifer Lee is at the University of California at Irvine. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Sin teaches at Queens College in New York. Welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
They both recently published studies about the foundations of Asian American success, and they are with us now. Professor Lee, let me start with you. You challenged the idea of tiger parenting in your current research, and actually even earlier. What's missing in the conventional wisdom that tough parenting styles are responsible for success?
That's an excellent question. And I would say that there are a couple things that's missing. One is that even from Amy Chua's background, she is the child of very highly educated parents. Her father was a professor at Berkeley, and so she is afforded a number of class resources that helped her get ahead, as are many of us who are East Asian or South Asian. If you look at profiles of these groups, they're more highly educated than other immigrants who come to the United States, and they're more highly educated than the average American. And so the children of Asian immigrants, like Chinese immigrants, tend to achieve high educational outcomes in part because their parents are so highly educated.
Professor Sin, you actually took on something that I think is rather sensitive, the idea of inherent genetic advantage. What did you find out, and what would you like to add to this conversation?
My co-author, Yuxi, at the University of Michigan, and I, we analyze over 5,000 Asian and white students who are followed from kindergarten through high school. And we find that Asians aren't doing better because they're smarter. They're also the advantages in family background, but it's an insufficient explanation as well, because even poor, disadvantaged Asian immigrants tend to do better than their white middle-class peers.
So that's what I wanted to dig into, that question. So even when you take away the benefit of having highly educated, affluent parents who presumably can supplement, you can have tutoring and all that other good stuff, what did you find then accounts for those higher scores and grades?
We found that work ethic primarily explains the Asian-white achievement gap in terms of grades. This is work ethic as measured by teacher ratings of children's attentiveness, their motivation, how hard they are perceived to work in the classroom.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that, though. I'm glad you brought up, you used the word perceived.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to test that they actually did work harder, or is it that their teachers believed that they did? In fact, if we could say perhaps they benefited from a positive stereotype, if I can put it that way.
We do find that, for example, Asians report spending more time doing homework than their white peers. And so some of it is, I think, due to actual differences in behavior. But Asians are also perceived to be the model minorities. They're perceived to be more naturally gifted in terms of intellect and more studious by nature. And so this certainly affects the way teachers perceive students, by having higher educational expectations for Asian students, giving them more second chances. It also affects the way Asians see themselves and see achievement as both attainable and expected, and it may certainly help affect their performance.
You're both knocking down the idea that there's some genetic advantage. You're saying, so let's put that to the side.
Yes.
And you're both kind of knocking down the idea of, am I right that you're both knocking down the idea of like the tough parenting, you know, lock the kid in the basement to, you know, practice the violin and this business? Or Professor Lee, you're saying in part it's affluence, and Professor Sin, you're saying it's in part work ethic. Professor Lee, what about habits?
I think that that is an excellent point that Professor Sin brought up. And I would say a couple of things, that we also find that the children of working class parents who are Chinese and Vietnamese actually attain high educational outcomes. And so one of the things we find is that because Asian immigrant parents understand that mobility is possible in the United States, but they also fear that their children may face discrimination in the labor market as non-white Americans, they really supplement their children's education with after-school programs, and many of these are offered in their ethnic communities, so SAT programs. college prep courses, tutoring services, and some of those are either available at low cost or free. The importance of the fact that these are resources available in the ethnic communities and not equally available to all groups is an important point that I wanted to bring up.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about myths and facts around Asian American academic achievement with two sociology professors who have dug into this question closely in their research. We're speaking with Jennifer Lee of the University of California, Irvine, and Amy Sin of Queens College in New York. Did either of you detect, I think this was you, Professor Sin, that there was a downside to that positive stereotyping or that expectation of high academic achievement? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we analyze this in our data, and we find that Asians, relative to their white peers, tend to have poor self-image, and they also tend to have more conflicts with their parents. And we speculate that this is in part due to the high educational expectations placed on them by their families, by communities.
You know, we've heard this before from other groups. In fact, there's even jokes about this, like, is it something like a Jewish dropout, is somebody who only has a BA, that sort of thing? Or is there kind of a similar kind of cultural expectation among Asian Americans that if you don't meet that standard, becomes very painful?
It's not only just that when you don't meet those high expectations, you're less satisfied. The people we interviewed felt like they weren't Asian American, mm-hmm. and they were likely to reject their racial or ethnic identities because they didn't feel like they were like other Chinese. And their image of other Chinese Americans are those who are the highest achievers. So they're measuring their success against this exceptionally high bar. And I wanted to also take this moment to mention one of the more serious consequences of this. In the past few weeks, three Asian American college students committed suicide. And the most recent of whom was Jiwon Lee, a 29-year-old who is a fourth-year dental student at Columbia University. And she left a note in her room apologizing for not living up to expectations. And so I mention this because I think it's very important to understand that the stereotypes of the model minority are dangerous and have very real consequences that need to be addressed.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I was going to ask you, since both of you have delved into these sensitive areas, is that, you know, you've got other people whose intelligence is continually demeaned, whose mm-hmm. standing at academic institutions is consistently questioned, and they might wonder, why should we care? Help me, again, understand why you feel it's really important to understand these nuances, Professor Lee.
I think the downside, of course, is that most Asian Americans don't live up or meet this strict success frame. They're not all high achieving. They're not all doctors, lawyers, engineers. And so many who don't meet that exceptionally high bar feel like they're failures or ethnic outliers. And in extreme cases can lead to suicide. And it's not by accident that the number of suicides among Asian American students is higher than any other racial group in the country.
One other intriguing conclusion of your research that I wanted to ask you about before we let you go is that you say that the most successful immigrant community is actually Mexican Americans. Could you talk a little bit about why you say that?
I am so glad you brought that up, because I think so much of the way we define success is really about outcomes. Who has achieved the most? Who drives the nicest car? Who makes the most money? And when you look at where groups started, which I think is an important part of the success story that's often lost, you see that second-generation Mexican-Americans have made the most mobility. They double the high school graduation rates of their parents. They're doubling the college graduation rates of their fathers and tripling that of their mothers. And this is in Los Angeles, where there is an enormous Mexican-American population. And so when you think about how much success second-generation Mexican-Americans had based on public resources without the help of ethnic resources, it's very remarkable.
Jennifer Lee is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Irvine. She joined us from KUCI on campus. Amy Sin is a professor of sociology at Queens College in New York. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Professor Sin, Professor Lee, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Switching gears now, you're probably seeing a lot of ads for smartphones and other gadgets that a graduate might like. There are a lot out there, and they're changing all the time. And that made us think that technology is not the only thing changing quickly. There are also new ways to store information. We're no longer storing documents and photos on hard drives or USB sticks or even CDs or floppy disks, if you remember those. Many people today rely on clouds like Google Drive or Dropbox, and these allow us to access important documents anywhere on almost any device. But we wanted to know just how secure are clouds and what should we know before we use them. Joining us to tell us more is Nicole Perlroth. She is technology reporter for The New York Times, and she's with us now. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For people who are not familiar with the term, can you just tell us what a cloud is?
So the cloud is a really nebulous term, no pun intended, for computing done remotely. So you're using the cloud if you are working off of your Google Drive and you're creating a document in Google Drive. You're working from the cloud. You are using the cloud when you do online banking. You're using the cloud when you store something in a Dropbox account. And you're even using the cloud when you're watching Netflix, because Netflix outsources its data storage to Amazon's Web Services, which is a cloud computing provider.
Do you even have a choice anymore about whether you use the cloud?
You do have a choice, but it's getting people are moving to the cloud at a very fast rate. So gone are the days for small companies when most of their data is stored down the hall in a computing room. A lot of small and medium-sized businesses now outsource their data storage and data security to services like Amazon and Google and Rackspace and a number of cloud providers. And yes, you can still store documents on your computer or on your hard drive or on a time machine, but a lot of people are now migrating to the cloud because it's cheap, it's easy to access your documents from different devices, which is very convenient, and in a lot of businesses' cases, it's cheaper for them to sort of outsource their data storage and data security to someone like Amazon than to go build out their own warehouses to store their data themselves.
And, of course, if you lose that particular device or if it breaks, of course, people are just, you know, they're stuck, they're lost. It's almost like losing that old address book, and this way it's automatically sort of available somewhere else. But is there a downside? I mean, a lot of people are familiar with those big security breaches at the retailers that became known at the end of last year, right after the Christmas or even in the middle of the Christmas shopping season. And a lot of people were just terrified that they were suddenly exposed, that all their personal data was exposed. Is there something that people should know or be aware of about this?
Yeah, there are definitely risks. And one of them is, say, your cloud provider goes out of business. Say they're having financial troubles and they go out of business and they take all your data with them. Say that there's an outage, and this has actually happened several times, usually due to storms. But Amazon has a huge data warehouse in Virginia, and there's been a couple times where it's had an outage, and suddenly you saw all these services that you interface with, like Instagram and Pinterest and Netflix, all suddenly have problems because so much of their businesses are dependent on Amazon Web Services. So, you know, you want to make sure that whoever you're storing your data with in the cloud isn't likely to go out of business tomorrow. And same for security. What we're doing now with the cloud is we're sort of aggregating so much different data from so many different services in one cloud storage provider. And so if that cloud storage provider is not handling their infrastructure correctly or is not devoting enough resources to their security or hiring the right personnel or ensuring that they're not going to go out of business anytime soon or that a storm at one of their facilities doesn't affect all of their data, then you're certainly putting your data at risk.
So what are some of the common sense things that you do to insulate or protect yourself from these negative consequences? We have about a minute and a half left. Can you just give us some things that people can be doing on a common sense basis? Because you surely can't go and check their hiring records and say, are you sure you got the right people here? But,
right.
What can you do?
So I am notoriously paranoid because I am a cybersecurity reporter, and we have ourselves here at the New York Times dealt with a breach from a foreign nation state. So I'm notoriously paranoid. So I won't put anything very crucial. I won't put any of my sources' information in my Dropbox account, for example, or on Google Drive. But I do use it for things like my photos. I will, you know, I don't just want my photos saved on my phone. I will save them to my computer, and then I'll save them to my Dropbox account so that if I lose my phone or my computer crashes, at least I can access my photos from my Dropbox account. But for things like my social security number or things that, you know, if a cyber criminal got a hold of them or if the NSA got a hold of them, I would be in deep trouble. I don't put that stuff in the cloud. And I would say that I'm very much on the paranoid side of the spectrum. But if you want to be very secure, I would be very careful about what you're storing where.
Nicole Perlroth is technology reporter for the New York Times. She covers cybersecurity issues, as she just mentioned, and she was kind enough to join us from New York City. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just ahead, before he became the high-ranking Democratic lawmaker he is today, Congressman James Clyburn suffered through three tough losing campaigns. He says it was his wife who gave him the secret to staying in the game despite all those setbacks.
When you win, brag gently. When you lose, weep softly.
He shares other life lessons he's learned along the way in his new memoir, Blessed Experiences. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices, waltonk12.org. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at lifelock.com, code NPR. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
PRI's The World is People.
I begin my day by taking a brisk 40 minutes walk in the desert, which helps me knock everything into proportion.
The world is different.
When I come back home and switch on the radio and I hear politicians using words such as never, forever, or for eternity, I know the stones out in the desert are laughing at them.
Join us on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Tonight at 7 on the evening concert on WILL-FM. It's Salzburg Festival 2013. Antonio Pappano conducts the orchestra and chorus of the National Academy of St. Cecilia, plus vocal soloists, in Britain's War Requiem. Also on the program, the Vienna Philharmonic with Schubert's Third Symphony. That's Britain and Schubert on Salzburg Festival 2013, tonight at 7 on the evening concert on WILL-FM 90.9.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. If you follow politics at all, then you probably know that Congressman James Clyburn is one of the most powerful people on Capitol Hill. The South Carolina native, first elected in 1992, is now the third-ranking Democrat serving in the House, known both for his Southern charm and for his willingness to fight hard when he thinks the occasion warrants. But what you might not know about are his years in the trenches in the civil rights movement long before he got to Congress, the three unsuccessful elections along the way, and what keeps him going now. He talks about all of this in his remarkably candid new memoir, Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern, Proudly Black. And Congressman James Clyburn was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I said the book is candid, so let me tell you how it starts. When you say your BlackBerry vibrated at 2 a.m. on a January morning in 2008, and you say that there was a very familiar voice on the other end, okay, language warning here, saying, if you bastards want to fight, you damn well will get one. And that voice was the voice of?
Bill Clinton, the former president of the United States.
And he was highly upset that Mrs. Clinton had just been defeated in the South Carolina primary. Why did you want to open the book this way?
My intentions were to open the book with what is now Chapter 18. But the good friend of mine that had been working with me over the years, we had worked together in the governor's office, said to me, that is okay, except that people associate you with politics in the present. And the book will probably be much more attractive to people if you were to open the book with something very political, very cogent.
That people remember.
And people remember.
They remember that you all were fighting. Well, you say you later made up.
Yes, we did. And I don't think there was anything real that had to be made up. He supported his spouse, as we all would. She had lost, and he was very disappointed. And he registered that disappointment. But he felt that I was greatly responsible for her loss. I don't think so. I think that history was in the making.
Well, one of the reasons, though, I was interested in the fact that you told this anecdote and opened the book with it is that it is kind of a recurring theme, which is that race has been both a driving force and an animating force in your life.
Yes.
But also something that you have continually hoped would not be in some ways.
But I was also taught at a very early age is that some things will always be there. And I think race is something that, irrespective of how much we may try, it will always be there.
Let me talk to you about that, because one of the things that you do in the book is you describe some of the day-to-day indignities.
Yes.
That you grew up with.
Sure.
You and the other people who you continually say, as you put it in the book, people who look like me,
right,
were people who look like you,
right,
were forced to endure. I'm thinking about, for example, when you and your fellow marching bandmates were forced to the back of a big parade, behind even the horses and, you know, everything the horses leave behind. And like what that feels like to kind of not just be like a one-time thing, but an all-the-time thing. And I was just wondering, gee, you know, the scar tissue that has to come with that.
Yes, it comes, and it's there. It will never leave. I told my three children, there are certain things that will happen to you in life that will even out. I told my daughter, and this is in the book, when she went away to college, I says, look, when you get up on that campus, a lot of things are going to happen to you that are pretty good because you're Jim Clyburn's daughter. A lot of things are going to happen to you that ain't so good because you're Jim Clyburn's daughter. But all that will even out. Then I told her, there's some things that's going to happen to you because you're a woman and because you're black. Those things never even out. Those are the things you have to work at overcoming. And I still believe that. And I still teach young people that. Don't ever believe that things are post-racial. It will never be.
You know, to that end, though, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the other points that occurs in the book, and I think you're very honest about recounting this, are the confrontations that you sometimes have with political figures particularly, but not always, white political figures who say, actually, you're the one injecting race into these situations.
Sure. I've lived with that.
But to the point of people who say that actually it's black folks who are race obsessed now, what would you say to that?
I would say that's a lot of poppycock. The fact of the matter is, I know of no black person that feels empowered because he or she is black. I know a lot of black people who have decided to use their blackness as a strength, not because anything comes with it that you might call powerful, but to use it in order to overcome those things that may occur in your life.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Congressman James Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina. His new memoir is called Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern, Proudly Black. Just let's go back to some of your early life for a minute. Your dad was a minister. Your mom was a beautician.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you struggled with a decision yourself. You were attracted to the ministry, but ultimately instead you said you actually still second-guessed your decision not to go into ministry. Well, what made you go toward activism first and then politics?
Well, I was so indoctrinated with the thought that you're called to the ministry. You're not born in it. You're supposed to be called. And I kept listening. And I never heard the call. So I went home to tell my dad. I told him that I decided that I would not follow him into the ministry, that I was going to do something else. I thought my dad would be disappointed by that. And he may have been. But he said to me on that occasion, "Well, son," he said, "I suspect the world would much rather see a sermon than to hear one." Now that, to me, said it all. And so most of what I do is very faith-based. And when I talk about legislation in the Congress, I think about what will this impact be on the least among us.
One of the fruits of your activism was that you met your wife. Kind of a...
Well,
you kind of met cute.
Well,
for that era.
We got married on June 24th, 1961.
Mm-hmm.
The meeting took place on March 15th, 1960. I was sitting in the jail waiting to be bailed out, and she came to bring food to those of us who had not eaten all day. And she brought this hamburger, and I reached for it, thought she was handing it to me, but she pulled it back, broke it in half, gave me half of it. She ate the other half. So I told her about it. I came very cheap. One half a hamburger. I was so grateful. 18 months later, we got married.
Well, there are some other interesting things about that. I wonder why it is. Politics is very famously hard on marriages, as we see
often.
Too often. And I'm wondering, what do you think the secret of the longevity of your union has been, particularly given that it has not been easy for you? One of the things I'd forgotten until I read your memoir is that you had, in fact, three unsuccessful campaigns before you were finally elected to Congress. And it is worth noting, you were already a father by then.
Yeah.
You already had kids to support. And you were already at a time when a lot of people are kind of doing other things or getting out of politics, as you pointed out. You were just starting in Congress. And I just sort of wonder, what do you think the secret is of your staying together all these years when politics is so hard on other people?
Well, I think 1970, when I ran, I won the primary. And we had this big party that night. I mean, no black person had ever served in the South Carolina legislature. And so everybody was celebrating. That night, when I got home, celebrating continued to the wee hours of the morning. My wife went to bed. The next morning, after when I got up, I went into my bathroom, and up on the mirror was a little stickum. And written on that stickum were these words: "When you win, brag gently. When you lose, weep softly." My wife had written that and put it up on the mirror for me to read. I read it, and I let it stay there. That following November, I was declared the winner in the general election at 10 o'clock in the evening. About 3:30, the doorbell rang. A TV reporter was at my door saying, "You better get down to the courthouse. Something has happened." We went down there, and sure enough, I was told that rather than being a 500-vote winner, I was a 500-vote loser. I went back home that morning, and I walked into that bathroom. That little stickum was still there. I wept softly. That has always stuck with me. My wife has always been very, very practical, very realistic, very forgiving, and therefore we have been able to stay married all these years. Those three things, I think, are the secrets, if there is a secret.
Speaking of weeping softly, if you don't mind my mentioning this, I spoke to you on the day that Barack Obama was nominated for the presidency. Yeah. You were very emotional.
I was.
I don't know if you mind my mentioning that.
No, I don't. And I remember that night that we talked. I had invited all my political supporters to this big event. There must have been 400 or 500 people in the room. And I looked back, and my three daughters, tears were streaming down their faces. And I looked at my wife, tears streaming down her face. And I thought I was the big man in the crowd. And before I knew it, tears were flowing. They were tears of joy because, you know, you grow up believing in certain things. But the one thing I never believed was that I would live to see an African-American elected president.
You did not?
No. I never thought I would. Every time I think about that night, I still get choked up.
Do you feel that he has fulfilled the hopes that you had for him?
Well, serving in the Congress, one of the things you know is that some things a president cannot do, and the president cannot pass legislation. He can ask for it. He can proclaim it, but we have to pass legislation. What I was not prepared for, and I don't think the president was prepared for, the significant animus that would be generated by his elections. And I don't care what anybody says about it. The fact of the matter is, so much of this is personal.
You mean personal because it's Barack Obama, personal because he's a black man, or personal because he's the black man he is, which is a progressive liberal or whatever?
Well, a lot of people say it's about progressive liberalism, but that may be it with some people. But the fact of the matter is, nobody likes to go there, and I don't like to have to go there. But being the honest person that I am, I read my mail sometimes, and I get reports on the phone calls, and a lot of the reaction to me, it's got nothing to do with a position I may take. It's got to do with who I am and what I am. And I read the mail, and some of it I've posted up on my wall. I've framed to keep there because it goes back to what I said to my daughter. Let me tell you a little bit about the end of that story. Thanksgiving, I went to pick Mignon up from school. She called me and says, they're closing the dormitories for Thanksgiving. I need to go home. On our way home, a car passed me, and she said to me, she said, Dad, did you see that car that just passed? I said, yes. Did you see the bumper sticker on it? I said, yes. The bumper sticker was George Rogers for Heisman. George Rogers was the African-American football player at the University of South Carolina who was a candidate for the Heisman, which he won. She says, do you believe that man would put your bumper sticker on his car? I says, probably not. But why, do you ask? She said, well, I didn't understand what you were saying to me when I left to go to school until the homecoming game. I says, what happened at homecoming? She said, at homecoming, we had a black homecoming queen. And when she was introduced at halftime, she was booed. And then I noticed that from the section of the stands where the loudest boos came, that was the section of the stands that cheered the loudest when George Rogers was introduced at the beginning of the game. I said, okay, and that told you what? That is all right for us to entertain, but they don't want us to represent them.
But, you know, you also tell this story in the book of how your car, when your car went off the road one day, how a pickup truck comes with a full Confederate, you know, the Confederate flag thing in the back window. And you're thinking, okay, here we go. Yeah. And then they stop and pull you out and won't take any money. And they said, no, we just want to help you, you know, and went on their way. And so.
Well, if you remember from that story, it ended by me looking at them and saying, just when I thought I had this flag thing all figured out.
Right.
And that's part of the contradictions that come with all of this. And that's why, one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I want young African-Americans to understand that a lot that people act out with may be misplaced, but a lot of it is their learned behavior from what they've been taught. These two young men that pull us out of that swamp were construction workers from Georgia, but they had worked side by side in that cement plant there in Hollyville, South Carolina, with enough black people to get beyond that for the moment. We see it on football fields, on basketball courts. They work together to get beyond that for the moment. At some point in time, a lot of them will internalize it and live it.
That was actually going to be my final question, which is, why did you want to write this book, particularly why now? What are you hoping that people will draw from it?
I wrote this book with the 10th grade students I used to teach in mind. And I made sure that every time I finished a part of the book, I would go back through it and I would say to myself, with those students sitting in my 10th grade class, understand this. Will they learn something from this? Will it do some good for them going forward? And if I could not answer each one of those questions in the affirmative, I went back and rewrote. So this book was written as a primer, and about thinking about politics, and about wondering about what it's like to be in this business. This book would be a reference book for them. Anybody teaching the 10th grade class would be able to use this book as a reference.
That was Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina, Democrat. His new memoir is called Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern, Proudly Black. And he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Congressman Clyburn, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.